From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Femi Okeh. It's Here and Now. The president meets with congressional Republicans this evening to discuss immigration. There's a lot to talk about. Republicans remain divided over the administration's policy of separating children from their parents at the border. And the House of Representatives considers two rival immigration bills. One has the support of GOP moderates. The other takes a harder line and appeals to conservatives. But Republicans in both chambers of Congress are feeling pressure to address the policy at the border. We're joined now by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi there, Mara. With the president and GOP lawmakers. What's happening ahead of that today?
Well, the big question is what the president is going to decide to do about these two pieces of legislation in the House. He said that he would sign either of them, but he hasn't really thrown his weight into the lobbying effort. He hasn't decided he wants to heave one of them over the finish line. The other thing that's happening in advance of this huddle is that Republicans are under a lot of pressure to stop the policy of separating families, or at least be able to cast a vote to show they tried to stop it. And there's now talk about a standalone bill. In other words, a bill in the House and Senate that would just stop this policy. It wouldn't address all of the other issues that those two House bills you mentioned address. It wouldn't address the Dreamers or the border wall or the big cuts in legal immigration that the president has demanded.
Mara, it sounds like there's this great sense of urgency to get something done. What would be the time span for this?
Well, the president himself could stop this policy if he wanted to. But up until now, he has said that this policy should be addressed as part of a bigger immigration bill. And he's laid down a lot of demands that the Democrats certainly don't want to consider. And everything that he's proposed has come up in the House and Senate in the past, and it hasn't gotten enough votes to become law. So the sense of urgency politically is that this is an issue that's splitting the Republican Party. The base loves it. The conservative base loves it. But Republicans who are in competitive districts are feeling a lot of backlash. Republicans who have a lot of Hispanics in their district, Republicans who are in districts that Hillary Clinton won. The public polling on this really explains this divide. 66% of Americans oppose this policy and only about 27% support it. But among Republicans, 55% support the policy and about 35% oppose it. And 70% of women don't like it. So if you think of all those suburban Republican women who are trying to make up their minds about who to vote for this year, Republicans are very nervous that this policy could hurt their chances in November.
Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain are some of the loudest voices who've spoken out against this separation of parents from children policy. Also, Senator Ted Cruz. Is it possible that there could be this huge clash of ideology when the president meets with Republicans?
Well, there probably will be a clash, but, you know, Jeff Flake and John McCain aren't the only ones who've spoken out. You have the chairman of the House Republican Campaign Committee who's spoken out against this. You have Republican candidates who are often very closely identified with Donald Trump, like Rick Scott in Florida, running for Senate. He says he's against it. So you're hearing a lot of Republicans who usually don't break with Donald Trump on anything saying that they want this policy stopped.
I saw earlier on today the president was tweeting about how this was more to do this issue, this policy with children being removed from their parents at the border, was to do with the Democrats' approach and their policy. What other guidelines, indications has he given?
The problem for the president is he wants to be tough on immigration, and he's continued to use extremely aggressive rhetoric about immigrants. He said yesterday these parents could be murderers and thieves. We don't want the U.S. to become a migrant camp. And he wants the credit for being tough on immigration, but he doesn't want to take responsibility for the unpopular part of his policy, which is separating children. So he's blamed it on the Democrats, which is not correct, because this practice of separating families came from a policy that he announced, zero tolerance for border crossers, and he could stop it if he wanted to. Even Republicans have said he could pick up the phone and stop it tomorrow. But he wants to use it as leverage to see if he can get a bigger immigration deal with some of his other priorities in it, like the wall, like a decrease in legal immigration. The big question is, will the president feel so much heat from his own party that he'll drop all those other demands for a bigger, more broader, right, comprehensive immigration bill and just go for something that stops family separations.
Thank you so much. NPR National Political Correspondent Mara Liasson.
Thank you.
Well, the World Health Organization is now saying what parents have suspected for a long time: video gaming can be addictive. The WHO has added gaming disorder to its International Classification of Diseases, a designation that's more than a formality. Mental health professionals say it can help them learn to treat patients. It might also push insurance companies to cover the treatment and signal to people it's okay to get help. Someone who's been providing help in one of only a handful of places offering residential help is psychologist Hillary Cash. She's co-founder of Restart, a facility for adults and adolescents in Washington State. She joins us by Skype. Dr. Cash, Hillary, for people who've been looking at their newspapers recently, your facility was featured in the New York Times. There was a huge, almost life-sized chessboard, an attempt maybe to get people to play real games?
Yes. We want people to get out and into the world and enjoying one another's company as well as enjoying the outdoors. And so that's one of the ways we try to lure them out.
Look, if you have had someone that you've loved, a young person in particular, play video games hour after hour in dark rooms with strangers, on headsets, you have seen how they change. But make the case that this really is a disorder, because there are people scoffing at that.
When the adults come, they're usually severely depressed. They failed out of high school. They failed in relationships, if they've even tried a relationship. They failed out of work. They're just at their wit's end, and many of them are actually suicidally depressed. Mm-hmm. They cannot get away from the games and the internet. And the kids we treat are between the ages of 13 and 18. When they come, most of them are in school refusal. They've stopped going to school, and they are fighting, really fighting with their parents in very severe ways, sometimes quite violently. And they are often depressed as well, but we see the school refusal and violent behavior at home as pretty common symptoms.
Yeah, we've covered school refusal quite a bit here. The New York Times quotes a doctor who says he has patients who come in who have an addiction to Candy Crush Saga, and they are similar to his patients who have cocaine disorders.
Yeah. Well, the brain imaging that is being done, the research in that field, is showing that the brain lights up in just the same ways, whether you're high on cocaine or high on a video game.
Look, 2.6 billion people play video games around the world, and that's two-thirds of American households. This is according to the Entertainment Software Association. And people push video games as things that can light up parts of the brain, that can be good for coordination. What do you say to that?
They say it is really good for hand-eye coordination. And if you're a surgeon, for instance, it really helps to play a video game before you go into surgery. But how many people kind of need that level of hand-eye coordination? Most of us don't. Mm. And what we also know is that it actually really impedes development in children in a number of areas, including their social development, their executive functioning, that prefrontal cortex. So it can impede development, I think, if it's introduced too young and children are allowed to play too much, it really can have detrimental effects.
The hope is that the WHO's designation might get some coverage from insurance companies, might take away the stigma. Do you see stigma? And we know that I think your facility is something like $30,000 for 7 weeks. Am I in the ballpark there?
Yeah, it's $550 a day for the intensive phase of the program, and then the costs drop off way lower than that as time goes by, as they stay longer in the program if they choose to. And of course, it would be enormously helpful if insurance would be convinced to pay for it. This does open the door for that, although it takes a long time for the insurance companies to make the changes they need to make internally. And it requires pressure from the purchasers of insurance.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the point is that this is how desperate people are, that they're paying this out of pocket. You hope that the insurance company begins to contribute. And there are other avenues. Game Quitters is an online forum. It's got 50,000 people a month from 91 countries, you know, trying to use talk therapy and maybe yoga to get out of gaming. For somebody who's listening right now who can't afford the rehab, what's the first thing you'd say to them?
You need support. You need not to be isolated. So find a therapist who understands gaming disorder. find a support group, and that might be through a 12-step meeting, maybe Gamblers Anonymous. We've started one called Internet and Technology Addicts Anonymous. Find a 12-step meeting where you can be part of a community. If you're a parent struggling with your kids, go to Al-Anon. It's really helpful to have support out there in the world.
Al-Anon, again, for loved ones of alcoholics, but it can be broad and apply to any addict.
And there's some excellent books out there. People can get educated and get a lot of help that way.
We'll put some of your recommendations at hereandnow.org. Hillary Cash, Chief Clinical Officer at Restart, a residential facility treating video game addiction in Falls City, Washington. The WHO has just designated it a disorder. Dr. Cash, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The latest collection from poet Terence Hayes is out today. It's called American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin. Actual assassins appear, like the church shooter Dylan Roof or the Ku Klux Klansman who killed Medgar Evers. Then there are the assassinations by a thousand cuts, he writes in one poem. Even the most kind-hearted white woman, dragging herself through traffic with her nails on the wheel, her head in a chamber of black modern American music, may begin almost carelessly to breathe N-words. The poems were written during the first 200 days of the Trump presidency. They're political, they're personal. Terence Hayes won the 2010 National Book Award for his collection Lighthead, and he joins us from NPR New York with a look at this latest collection. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you are African American. You're writing about black men being targeted by police or being targeted by young white men. I mentioned Dylan Roof, the church shooter in Charleston. But it's not always clear who you mean by assassin. In one line, you write, "Assassin, you are a mystery to me, I say to my reflection. Sometimes you are beautiful because of your sadness, but you would be more beautiful without your fear." You're talking to your own reflection. Are you one of the assassins?
See, now that's funny because, you know, that I in the poem is kind of a shadow me. So even when you put it to me so directly, I think, no, I'm not anywhere in this book. But of course, I'm everywhere. So, sure, the assassin shifts and changes, and sometimes it's a reflection, sometimes a shadow, sometimes an image on the television. So, yeah, it does shift, it does change, and, you know, it can feel like that sometimes.
Well, why? Because of self-loathing, or you say you'd be more beautiful without your fear. Is it the fear that kills you?
Oh, wow, okay, that's a deep question. Is it self-loathing? That sounds maybe even too one-dimensional. I mean, part of what I'm doing as a poet is always trying to activate that space between the lines. And so I would say it's always hard to kind of settle on one. So self-loathing just seems like maybe a little too straightforward. But self-doubt, uncertainty probably is a bigger, more common notion.
Or fear. Fear,
all of that.
As you lay out, you know, what you should be fearful of, you know, all the modern-day assassins, and also fear that really hasn't been expressed as much as the American black man would have every right to. And I'm thinking there's a series of poems which you start with the line, "But there never was a black male hysteria." Now, you know, male hysteria was a really debated topic around the turn of the last century. It was post-traumatic stress, but, you know, they didn't have a word for it then. What are you saying in that line, "There never was a black male hysteria"?
There are two things. There's a sort of the truth of the poem's inspiration, which would be rooted in a friend, a fellow poet from many years ago, who said he was working on a collection of poems, African-American male poet, which I thought the title was Black Male Hysteria. Maybe it was just male hysteria, but it never came out. He sort of had some trouble just sort of adjusting to the world as a poet. And so I've thought about him and carried that idea and thought about both the poet in that space, and then, of course, as a black man in that space. So in a simple way, it is me thinking about, well, are we crazy? Like, would the world really be able to endure a true psychotic break from a black man, from women, even any oppressed spirit? And so you think the only reason there hasn't been that kind of critical break is because of one's compassion under the pressure. And so it's sort of like you should be glad.
Right.
You should be glad there's never been any kind of real craziness as a response or as an answer to violence.
Well, this is so great. Let me just make sure I've heard you right. So you, in a very literal sense, your friend never wrote the book that you thought was going to be titled Black Male Hysteria. So, but there never was a black male hysteria. But
exactly.
I was reading the second meaning, which is either, you know, black men didn't have the luxury And white America was really spared what
absolutely
really should have happened after the torture.
And both those things are true. I mean, that's often, even the title of the book is always playing with those ideas of paradox and duality, so that it can be love poems for someone trying to kill you, or it could be a very literal male hysteria, black male hysteria, and a very figurative one at the same time.
Well, although I'm sure you know there are scholars who would say, well, there are more than scholars who would say that African Americans internalized that, couldn't
sure
do it outwardly, so they internalized it. You know, a lot of the violence and other things that we've seen.
And also turned it into art, you know,
yep,
turned it into blues, gospel, banjo
poetry
playing, poetry, of course. Yeah, so rap. I think that is sometimes the result. Will you make this pressure into a thing that's useful, or will you make it into a kind of thing that you're going to fight against?
Do you have a piece that you can read for us? None of them have titles. They all have different, you know, they have first lines, and that's how they're in the index. So the title of all of them is the title of the book, American
right
Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin.
Well, you know, what I did with this one was just to write one that kind of explained it. So that way, whenever I'm reading these poems, I try not to talk very much. I just say the title and read it. Mm-hmm. So this would be me setting up the other poems by reading this poem. I lock you in an American sonnet that is part prison, part panic closet, a little room in a house set aflame. I lock you in a form that is part music box, part meat grinder, to separate the song of the bird from the bone. I lock your persona in a dream-inducing sleeper hold while your better selves watch from the bleachers. I make you both Jim and Crow here. As the crow, you undergo a beautiful catharsis trapped one night in the shadows of the gym. As the gym, the feel of crow poop dropping to your floors is not unlike the stars falling from the pep rally posters on your walls. I make you a box of darkness with a bird in its heart. Voltas of acoustics, instinct, and metaphor. It is not enough to love you. It is not enough to want you destroyed.
Who's the you?
This is one of the poems that had a kind of Trump-like figure. But when I was working on that poem, I was again saying, yeah, I am an American, and I feel pretty good about that. Every day, even when the country's trying to kill me, I still feel pretty good about being an American. And when I grew up, what I did, when I kind of felt this way, was try to make stuff. And so I feel like I'm still doing that, just trying to write my way through very strange times.
Well, and we're thinking of things that have happened along the way. You know, a president who equated both sides at a rally that saw white supremacists and Nazis facing off against protesters. And we're seeing more of police shootings of unarmed black men because of social media. What is the drip for you that has created the feeling that you have?
That November of 2016... I live in New York. I live by myself. I get out as a kind of exercise. But I have a family in Pittsburgh, and we all try to get together. So in November for Thanksgiving, we just decided, you know, New York and Pittsburgh were too extreme. So we met in the middle, which was the middle of Pennsylvania. And I just remember encountering people from the middle of Pennsylvania, which is not, it's not an urban center. Mm-hmm. People joke that it's really West Virginia. And there was just this weird kind of look what we've done silence. I mean, I went in, I think we all did, you know, black family, as I said, in a place that's not that many black people. We just kind of picked it. And everybody was kind, but even that I thought they might not be felt very different to me, that I had this sudden suspicious, this feeling of any white person I encounter might actually be aggressive. And as I said, they weren't. But even in that quiet, there was still a kind of trouble. And so, again, I feel like a lot of the poems, I'm trying to work out that. Like, even talking about it, I mostly say, well, I kind of wrote poems to try to get at these things that really everybody's still trying to figure out. It's just a sort of perplexing time.
You don't feel safe?
Again,
No, that's too head-on?
Uneasy. Yeah, uneasy is the question. And curious, too. I feel safe enough to write poems, but not safe enough to have my poems be about, you know, landscapes and mountains, not safe enough to say that I can't come to terms with, you know, the real violence that confronts us when we're on the streets. And us is always, you know, it's certainly black men, but I think it's also women, and it's black women, and it's children. I mean, everybody is confronting this certain dynamic, this certain power that just isn't something that you can ignore, is what I would say. So that distraction is where the poems come from. I just had no choice but to write them, because when I get up every day to write, I want to just sort of open my head up, and what I hear is, you know, the sound of America. And so that's what these become.
Some are pretty head-on, people who have assassinated blacks or the hope of blacks in Lincoln. And then I want to ask you about the poem I mentioned a little bit of, The Kind-Hearted White Woman, mm-hmm. who she's listening to Jay-Z and driving along. Before she knows it, she is maybe, as you wrote, carelessly breathing N-words.
Mm-hmm.
Could you pick up there and maybe read the rest of that?
Yes, even the most bespectacled hallucination cruising the lanes of America may find her tongue curls inward, entangling her windpipe, her vents, toes, and pedals when she drives alone. Even the most made-up layers of persona in a two- or four-door vehicle sealed in a fountain of bass and black boys chanting inwards may begin to chant inwardly, softly, before she can catch herself. Of course, after that, what is inward is absorbed. Mm. And I'm saying yes. Like, if you're in the car and you're listening to Kendrick Lamar and it's good, I have wondered what it is you would be saying. And I would say, well, if you're saying N words, that's okay. But, you know, once they're in you, they are in you. Mm. And again, like when you ask this question of the assassin and the reflection, I am saying it's not always intentionally violent. Sometimes it's just inconsequentially consequential. So I have a line in one of the poems, it's not the bad people who are brave that I fear, it's the good people who are afraid.
That's Terrence Hayes. His new collection of poems is called American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin. Terrence, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, Terrence is also wrapping up his tenure as poetry editor for the New York Times Magazine. Poet Rita Dove will rotate into that job next month.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Dow was down more than 400 points this morning, East Coast time, after President Trump threatened to impose another round of tariffs on Chinese goods. Meanwhile, shares in the Chinese telecom company ZTE dropped by more than 25% today after the Senate voted yesterday to go against President Trump and bring back the ban he lifted on the company. That ban prevented ZTE from doing business with American companies because it had violated a deal after admitting it evaded sanctions on Korea, North Korea, and Iran. And there's also news today that Russia will impose tariffs on some goods from the U.S. in response to aluminum and steel tariffs from the U.S. So let's bring in Robin Farzad, who hosts the podcast's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Good day to you.
Well, not for ZTE. Start there. The Commerce Department imposed this ban back in April for violating those sanctions on North Korea and Iran. The president later announced a deal to avoid the ban and have ZTE pay a fine. What do you make of the Senate's actions yesterday going against the president?
Yeah, Trump would like to use that as a traditional bargaining chip. He is, after all, a self-proclaimed deal maker. But there's rare bipartisanship in the Senate rebuke. If you look at the numbers and the people who typically do not get along and kind of sending that message, that shot across the bow, and look at how ZTE shares have tanked since they resumed trading, I think it speaks to the fact that there's a bit of asymmetric warfare here. There are companies that are extremely dependent on exports to the U.S. That are in China, and not many things that China can immediately do to pull strings here in the United States.
Well, moving to India, which has also announced tariffs on the U.S. this week, and we mentioned Russia has. I'm imagining the U.S. has trade with, these companies of these countries, China included. How big a deal is this?
Well, last year, China imported $130 billion from the U.S., but you have to compare that to China exporting $506 billion to the U.S. India, for its part, it has 1.3 billion people. It's a top five global economy. A lot of American multinationals do have designs on ultimately being big players in India, that's a very desirable emerging market consumer class. But if you're China right now, you can kind of take pot shots at big agriculture where you know that Trump has solid support. Foodstuffs and related commodities, if you think about the past 15 years, 16 years since China ascended to the WTO, they've been the buyer of size. And they can even hint at easing sanctions on North Korea. The problem is a lot of these things, as you know, Robin, is kind of if China follows through on them, it's more cutting off your nose to spite your face. China has more to lose. I mean, after all, it controls U.S. treasuries to be able to micromanage its economy. Mm. Do we really want to go that far, or do we just want to bark rhetorically?
Well, meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting, they reported this yesterday, that President Trump told Apple's Tim Cook that Apple iPhones, which are assembled in China, would be exempt from any tariffs. Are we going to be hearing about more exemptions?
Yes, you can imagine all the lobbying capability. Apple is the largest company in the United States by market capitalization. And if you step back on it, you look on the back of every iPhone or every iPad and it says, made in China for, designed by Apple in Cupertino, but it's manufactured in China. Is this something that's going to hurt the Chinese more than it hurts us? Apple does repatriate its profits back to the United States, but it employs tens of thousands of Chinese people.
Well, we're going to see how voters who supported Trump who are not getting the exemption will feel about that. Robin Farzad, host of the podcast Full Disclosure, thank you.
My pleasure.
Ford Motor Company's chairman Bill Ford laid out his vision today for renovating an iconic landmark in the city that has fallen into ruin, Michigan Central Station.
We want this station, a place where that many people suggested should be torn down, to be a beacon of development, opportunity, and possibility all over again. A destination for people to come visit from all around the world.
Michigan Central Station was instrumental to Detroit back in the city's heyday. It opened in 1913 with marble floors, bronze chandeliers, and a 54.5-foot tall ceiling. But as the city fell on hard times, so did the station. And in 1988, the last train departed for Chicago and the building was left vacant. So what do these new plans for Michigan Central Depot mean for Detroit? Daniel Howes is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News. He's also a commentator on Michigan radio. Daniel, can you tell us what this station actually looks like now? It's been abandoned for so long. How would you even describe it?
Yeah, I refer to it as the gap-toothed Hulk looming over Detroit. It's probably the most visible sign and symbol of Detroit's decline anywhere in the city. A number of the highways pass by it, so people coming through town see it. Residents moving around the metro area see it. They're constantly reminded that it's been sitting there for 30 years, and it's empty. It is just dead stone empty. There's a huge fence around it. The lobby is crumbling. But it's in a lot better shape, I think, than Ford Motor Company expected when they bought the building.
It's in an area of Detroit known as Corktown. It's named after County Cork in Ireland, where many of Detroit's immigrants came from. What do you think Ford see in this neighborhood? Why are they going into the Central Station and changing it?
Well, some of it's a little bit about geography. Mm-hmm. Ford Motor Company is about 7 miles up. Farther out Michigan Avenue, which is a spoke that goes out from the center of the city, essentially west into Dearborn and ultimately ends up all the way in Ann Arbor. The interesting thing about this historically is that it was that same spoke that Ford Motor Company during World War II used to create what we know as the Arsenal of Democracy, the Willow Run plant, the bomber factory. And now they're coming back to County Cork. The Ford family is originally from County Cork. Corktown is a near west side neighborhood to downtown. And one of the issues that we've been dealing with here in Detroit for the last several years has been enormous investment. I'm multiple billions of dollars of private sector investment in the downtown. And a lot of people have been saying, what about the neighborhoods? Well, this is the first major play in a neighborhood that will probably have enormous impact, I think, on a neighborhood like Corktown. And I don't know what it's going to be like in a couple, 3 years. I mean, they're saying it's going to take 4 years to do this project. Mm-hmm. They don't really know. That's an estimate. But I think you're going to see a lot more money going into that. In fact, Ford is encouraging other developers who develop in other parts of the city to look for projects to do there and say, this is not our town or our part of town. This is everybody's part of town, and we want you all to come in and be part of it. Ford is very focused on including the community in its decision making. It's been very clear and upfront with us early on to say we don't have a finite plan and we don't want to create a corporate enclave in Corktown. We want to be part of Corktown.
What's the broad plan, Daniel? You said the public will be involved, they'll actually be consulted, they can actually go in later on this month. But what's the broad plan?
They can go in this weekend. Ford, it's important to note, in this part of town in southwest Detroit, already has a presence, a community presence. They have a community center. Ford has been very good historically in having good relationships within the communities that it operates in. And technically, it doesn't even operate in the city of Detroit until very, very recently. They've been out of Detroit for 22 years when they sold the Renaissance Center to General Motors and left and went and consolidated everything into Dearborn.
There have been other attempts to look at this magnificent piece of architecture and regenerate it. People of Detroit, do they believe this time that Ford can do it?
I think so. What's different now is a couple of things. One is we're in a different time. There are things happening in Detroit with such speed right now that I think it's snapping the heads of a lot of people. I mean, they're just like, what? Billions and billions. And you drive around the city, and if you come back 2 or 3 weeks later, you will see new storefronts opening, brown paper on other ones saying, coming soon here, coming soon there. The excitement is palpable. The leadership is very different than it was when some of those other plans that you referenced were considered. The leadership now is not yoked to the past of Detroit. They're looking forward. They're much more cooperative. They're less partisan. You have a Republican governor who doesn't act like a Republican most of the time. You got a Democratic mayor who doesn't act like a Democrat, despite the fact that they're the most powerful people in their respective parties in the state. They work together. It's very business focused. How do we solve problems? How do we be pragmatic? It's very dependent on people and chemistry. So we're going to be electing a new governor at the end of the year. I think one of the big questions in my mind is, how does that affect this chemistry? And we don't really know how that's going to happen until it happens.
Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
To New York now, where the city's taxi drivers union is mourning what it says is the sixth suicide by one of its drivers in recent months. Abdul Salah, a 59-year-old immigrant from Yemen, was found dead in his rented Brooklyn room on Friday in what the taxi union dubbed a death from financial desperation. Salah was short on the lease for his cab. Many taxi drivers have been struggling financially because of the growth of ride apps like Uber and Lyft. Joining me now for more is Bara V. Desai. She's a founding member and spokeswoman for the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Bara V., I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about Abdul Salah? He'd been driving a cab for decades, sending money back home. What else do you know about him?
Well, we know that, you know, he had a really strong community of drivers, and he'd been driving for 30-plus years. He worked mostly the airports and the hotel lines, you know, two locations where there have just been fewer and fewer fares, particularly at the airports where, you know, drivers once upon a time could count on out-of-town fares where, you know, you'd make a pretty good living from those. All of those fares are, you know, they're now reducing, or passengers are just haggling to lower those rates of fare. So it's just been really hard for people to earn a living.
There have been so many taxi driver suicides in New York in the past 6 months. What is it that you're able to offer your members, your drivers, as a way of support, by means of supporting them?
Well, one, I just want to say, you know, it's a real race to the bottom across this industry. New York City has the largest taxing for hire vehicle industry in the country. We have four different sectors, and we've now seen suicides by drivers from three of these sectors. You know, we've been offering both mental health services, but also financial services to help with evictions and foreclosures and bankruptcies. But the main thing we've been doing is we've been fighting on the streets. We've been calling for regulation because this economic crisis is a result of political failure. It's a result of the city not regulating companies like Uber and Lyft, who have a destructive anti-worker business model that's destroying not only taxi and livery and black car drivers, but also has left Uber drivers themselves in poverty. So we're calling for change through regulation.
How are those negotiations, the talks going with New York City Hall? Are they even talking to you?
Well, it has just felt too slow. I mean, there is an urgency here. Drivers need to know that the city council and the mayor are going to step up. 3 years ago when they tried, Uber spent close to $10 million in attack ads. And so, and they do this across the country, which leaves a lot of elected officials reluctant, scared, or simply bought off. But I think this time there's a momentum. We feel that there's consciousness and there's community support. We started a protest outside City Hall just yesterday. I can't tell you the number of New Yorkers and tourists who stood with us at the protest line. We know that the people have our back and change will come, and we are getting that message out to the drivers in New York City and really across this country. You have to fight. You have to fight on the streets in order to get change inside City Hall.
Bayrovi Desai is the founding member and spokeswoman for the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Bayrovi, thank you.
Thank you.
Part of the move to curb the opioid crisis is causing fear in the medical community, doctors who fear they'll be prosecuted for prescribing opioids. One result, a growing population of patients no one seems to know what to do with. They're with chronic pain, already dependent on opioids, and now needing to find new doctors willing to treat them. From Rochester, New York, Karen Chikurji reports.
One day, Rebecca Shriver was at work helping an elderly patient get to the bathroom when the patient became unsteady.
So if I didn't put my leg out or tried to catch her, she would have cracked her head on the wall.
Shriver was a nurse at the time in Buffalo, New York. She had twisted her knee a few months earlier, and that day, as she tried to keep her patient from falling, things took a turn for the worse.
We both fell, and that resulted in the disease I have now.
Shriver developed something called complex regional pain syndrome. It's a chronic pain disease that, over the past 7 years, has spread from her right leg to her groin, buttocks, and back.
It's like I can feel the nerves, and I can feel them just on fire.
To deal with the pain, Shriver took the drug hydrocodone for years. But when she missed an appointment with her doctor and couldn't reschedule right away, she ended up without medication. Her pain became unbearable and she went into withdrawal. Next stop, the ER, where she got pain pills and injections. But once she was able to see her doctor,
she accused me of buying street drugs. She said those words exactly. I know you bought street drugs.
Shriver says her doctor explained that a urine test showed elevated levels of her medication, something that Shriver thinks may have manifested because of her visit to the ER. Her doctor decided to stop treating her, adding Shriver to a growing population of patients across the country called inherited patients, who have to find a new doctor to treat their pain when another doctor discontinues their treatment.
I felt abandoned and just scared, overall scared.
Ultimately, she kind of eventually really found herself without anybody to really take care of those medications.
This is Dr. Paul Updike, medical director for substance abuse services at Catholic Health in Buffalo. Shriver was referred to Updike by the doctor who stopped treating her for pain. He says the epidemic has put physicians on high alert that opioids can lead patients to addiction, something that takes time to monitor and determine.
As the concerns have become more and more, providers are less and less inclined to go through that work, and they're just more inclined to say, okay, I can't do this anymore, and stop the prescription. Which really may not be the best move.
Some doctors are also concerned because of growing regulations and investigations. The Drug Enforcement Administration, for example, recently announced 28 arrests and revoking 147 licenses.
Throughout the country, there's been so many of these cases that more and more physicians are afraid that they are going to get into trouble if they prescribe these medications to a patient.
DEA does not regulate the practice of medicine. You know, DEA has no interest in regulating the practice of medicine.
John Martin is the assistant administrator for the Diversion Control Division at the Drug Enforcement Administration. He worked on that latest surge to investigate what he calls dirty doctors.
There's that small percentage of practitioners that are not following the law. If they're doing what they are taught in medical school and through their continuing education, they have nothing to fear. We do not want to get in the way of a doctor and his or her patient.
But what about the patients? How do all these investigations impact patient care?
It shouldn't affect a patient getting the proper medication that they need. Again, that is not our intent of doing, you know, these enforcement actions. Our intent is to stop the diversion of controlled pharmaceutical drugs that are contributing to this epidemic that we have.
But in some cases, and for all kinds of reasons, patients do find themselves cut off from medication they've become dependent on. Dr. Douglas Gourlay says stopping prescriptions alone is not the solution.
It presupposes that all of those inherited patients will quietly go off in the corner and suffer and do nothing about it. The reality is they do plenty about it.
Gourlay is the former director of pain and chemical dependency at the Wasser Pain Management Center in Toronto. He's been writing about inherited patients for years. He points out that opioid prescribing guidelines tend to address what to do with new patients, leaving physicians unsure of how to help patients already taking opioids.
What do you do with all the people who we put on opioids? Are we simply willing to accept that a big number of them will die? Because they're going to buy pills off the street? I mean, is that a win?
Rebecca Shriver considers herself lucky. She found new doctors to treat her. She stopped taking hydrocodone for pain and now takes medical marijuana and Suboxone instead. Both help her manage pain and withdrawal.
It's like a fog has been lifted from my brain.
Shriver says she's happier with the regimen she's on now. She just wishes that she didn't have to have such a traumatic break in treatment to get on it. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Chakurji.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Femi Okeh. This is Here and Now.